Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
And welcome again to another great edition of the NIDS View. Again, don't change your dials. I am not Adam Lowther. He is out on assignment this week. I'm Curtis McGiffin, keeping the seat warm. And today I've got Jim Petrosky with us, and a special treat, Garrett Heron-Sack, a former Air Force member. I'll let him choose to expand as he desires, and just an all-around great and smart guy. So I hope that you'll all enjoy this. And as you know, if you are a faithful few who follow us regularly, when I host, I tend to do a little news roundtable. And we're at the end of January, and I think it's time to sort of look back at January. We're going to kind of ignore the election. That's big news, but we're going to kind of skip through that and look at a couple of things that have occurred this month that have, quite frankly, piqued my interest as we look at our nuclear news, if you will. So, gentlemen, welcome. And if you're ready, we'll get started here. So I think...
Thanks, Curtis. I just wanted to mention also, you know, this is an opportunity for me to say thank you, General Heron-Sack, for being a member of our organization, coming here on our podcast this early on. I'm looking forward to your views and what you're doing with us. So thanks. And aside from that, it's not quite the end of the month, Curtis. We still have another podcast this month, next week.
Well, we'll see. When this one comes out, it will be the end of the month.
Very, very true. Very true.
Because our engineer keeps us on time.
That's right.
Anyway, okay. Hey, so I think the biggest news of the month actually was a report from the Secretary of State. I think it was dated on here, the 17th of January. So it's under the Biden administration, just prior to inauguration. They sort of pushed out their last report on the status and implementation of the New START Treaty. This report is an annual report that's required by the the treaty requirements, and this is, if you will, a report to Congress. And as you might guess, it's probably not great news. And I just want to call out a couple of I recommend our listeners definitely check it out online. But for me, there were a couple things that were of great highlight, and that is that, of course, we're still in year two of Putin's suspension of the treaty, and they've noted that Putin is not complying with the treaty. We've had no verification inspections for over 4 years, and we have. And we've not been exchanging numbers and telemetry and these sorts of things as required. But one of the things here I wanted to note here as we get into our conversation is the United States, this is a quote, the United States is unable to make a determination that the Russian Federation remained in compliance through 2024. I'm not sure that should surprise us because they've suspended it. and then it goes on to say here that the United States assesses with high confidence that Russia did not engage in any large-scale activity above the treaty limits in 2024. However, Russia was probably close to the deployed warhead limit during much of the year and may have exceeded the deployed warhead limit by a small number during portions of 2024. Therefore, this constitutes a serious compliance concern. I think this was the biggest news out of this report. I want to turn to you, Zach, on your thoughts here, your impression of not only this, maybe the whole report, but at least specific to that. Can it be both things? Can it be sort of they were in compliance, but they were slightly over.
Well, first,
but it is a serious problem.
Curtis, Jim, it's a pleasure to join you guys. I was here when you guys started this great endeavor at NIDS, and I cheered you on from the sidelines when you did it, because I knew it was going to contribute in a very real way to the conversation of our deterrent and our security as a nation. And so I'm thrilled to be joining you guys as you all work, this incredible team works to secure America's future and our allies' future. So it's great to be here. Answer your question, Curtis. I will tell you, neither one of them surprised me. I'm surprised that people would be surprised that the Russians are either not complying, and we know certainly are not complying with the treaty that said they were leaving it anyway, or suspending it. So they're not gonna do the verification stuff, and I'll tell you, again, what surprises me most is that people are surprised about it. That being said, I do think that I've always been a strong supporter of START treaties or whatever it might be, because it's better than nothing. And that's where I fall, because a lot of people will say, well, what are you going to do? The Russians are cheating, or the Russians aren't complying. And my response to that has always been, duh. this is the way of the world. and we should know that going in, as Papa Reagan used to say, right? Trust but verify. And anytime you're going to be dealing with particularly these actors, I think the Chinese are the same way, and not to even mention North Koreans or whatever, you have to realize, even when you get into these treaties and you actually make a pact or whatever it is, that you've got to be realistic. I'm not an optimist when it comes to world affairs. I'm a realist, and in realism, you got to realize people are going to cheat on these things, and you're not going to do it. It's incumbent on us, though, to ensure that we do the best that we can to see where they are. Am I worried that there are a few deployable warheads or sub above or whatever? To me, that's that's all chaff and flares. It should take us away from the real aspect. Is currently, right now, they are not committed to verifiable arms control. And that being said, though, what choice do we have? I mean, we we've said for how many decades, hey, we really need to have China involved also as we move forward here. And that's a whole nother 25 podcasts, right? That whole idea. But even when China comes in, we have to go in clear eyed, knowing that they're going to probably do what they can hide and cheat and all that other stuff. All that being said, though, what have we said? We've always said we want China in anyway. Why? Because it's good. It's better for us if we could at least have these agreements and these structures moving forward.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm not sure I totally agree with you on this, but this is it's an interesting perspective. Jim, let me ask you this. The report goes on to say that the United States continues to assess that there is not a strategic imbalance between the United States and Russia, although the report has told us they may have deployed more warheads. And it goes on to say that that the American arsenal is quote, sufficient to deter strategic attack, assure allies and partners, and respond in the event of an adversary attack. And this further underscores the vital importance of retaining a modernized, safe, secure, and effective U.S. nuclear deterrent and achieving resilient and adaptive nuclear security enterprise. What do you think of that? Is there a strategic imbalance or not? And is what we have sufficient?
Well, that's a good question, Curtis. But before I start, because you gave the question across to SAC that I wanted, is what do you think of it? Which my answer would have been, meh. You know, of course we expected this. They pulled out of it a long time ago, and this report basically restates that. However, there's a little bit more in or maybe missing from the report that really bothers me, and you strike at that here. I'm a scientist. I like working on data. So when I don't have data, then how can I say what I have and don't have? So earlier on, you said, well, the Russians have cheated. Well, they may have violated. I don't know if they cheated. I don't know. I don't know because we're not verifying. So when you say, have they cheated on the numbers that they had recorded before or will record in the future or what they're doing in the future? I don't know because we're not verifying. Now, we may have other means for doing that. That's fine. But in the open, I don't know. I also question if they pull out of the treaty. But first of all, if they're not having verification on their behalf. Remember, we're not having verification on our behalf either. So it's going both ways, and that's hopefully going to bring someone to the table somewhere. But we've got to use that as either leverage or not. And the second piece to your question is, it all depends on how you want to interpret this. If you say Russia pulled out of the treaties, but they're following all the rules they would have had in a treaty anyway, and you trust that, then good luck. If you say they're not verifying and they're cheating, then what do we do to get that to stop? There's got to be a process that we have and a strategy we have to take that on. And I don't see any of that in this report. Aside from these very strongly worded having a serious compliance concern, well, I'm glad we have a serious compliance concern. What the heck are we doing about that serious compliance concern? And that's what I walked away when reading this and why I said, meh, I knew that. What are we going to do with this on this report? Because there's a lot of words here to say basically Russia pulled out of the treaty. Yeah, we knew that. Now what?
Well, I think if you read through this, the words are very finely tuned to convey a message without upsetting, spooking the herd, if you will, with regard to the United States. This kind of sort of might have gone over the limit, but it's not a big deal, but it is a big deal kind of language, I think really waters down the whole process of what these treaties are supposed to mean. And when America tolerates the cheating in any sort or verification issues, then you have to ask, what is the purpose? And why is that somehow stabilizing to the world? It's never computed with me. So the last thing I guess I will add to that is that, if why are we going to continue to remain in a treaty all by ourselves? That's essentially what we're doing. And that's never made any sense to me or the Gipper.
but I will say though, your point is valid in saying, these numbers, and I've got in my screen, I have SAC in one side window and Curtis in the other window. So I feel like I'm stuck in between the two. I do agree with SAC in that, some of these numbers, they were numbers formulated with some detail, but there's some fudge in some of these numbers in terms of what does it take to deter war? What does it take to bring people to the table? However, the compliance to those numbers matters in showing that you are trustworthy. And that's the point, is the verification. When you say 1,550, well, 1,551 means you blew it, and 1,549 means, hey, you're going a little bit over. And, so I want to know where Russia is on that number so I know where they're headed and what they think of how we, how we operate. What does it take to deter?
Right. Okay. Well, I want to, in the interest of time, I do want to move on, but I will we're going to move on because I think the next article is really going to help here as we look at this. So, in of all places, TASS, a report came out on January 21st, and the headline is, quote, Trump, Putin could strike informal deal to maintain caps on nuclear weapons, says an analyst. Well, that analyst apparently was an interview with Daryl Kimball of the Arms Control Association. He goes on to say, hey, there's a possibility that they could make an informal deal to commit each side to maintain existing limits on their strategic arsenals. Those things don't compete, right? An informal commitment, it, to me, doesn't compute. But any case, is his quote, Trump and his team have not yet offered a plan for constraining Russia's nuclear strategic arsenal, and that they believe they can outspend Russia and China in an all-out arms race. Well, I'm not sure that that's true anymore. And of course, President Trump's only been in office here a couple of weeks, so that doesn't surprise me. And then this idea that we can constrain Russia's strategic arsenal, the whole idea of them suspending the treaty was to be unconstrained, other than what they want to tell us moving forward. And so anyway, it goes on to say here that instead, Trump and Putin could try to achieve what Biden and Putin could not, a simple informal deal pledging each side to maintain the existing caps on their strategic arsenals and so forth to forestall costly arms races and the things that Mr. Kimball fears most. We've seen the success of informal deals, if you will, like the Budapest Memorandum and what that effect has been in Europe. I would argue these things don't work. If a treaty isn't going to compel, a formal signed treaty isn't going to compel Mr. Putin to want to remain in the treaty, what is an informal agreement going to do? So again, I'll jump over to Herman Sachser. Your
totally
thoughts
in agreement
on that,
Curtis? A colossal waste of time, energy, and focus. Informal agreements with someone who we already know isn't complying, or we believe isn't complying with a formal agreement. I mean, why would we waste time with that? Right. Even from our side, why would we want to say, hey, I've got an informal agreement here? It's just not realistic, and it's frankly not worth anybody's time or effort to do that. It doesn't make any sense. It makes a nice article. It may make somebody feel, oh, that would be great if in the absence of a formal agreement, let's do an informal one. No, we have an absence of a formal agreement because they don't want to comply with it, or they want to suspend it, or whatever. So why would we waste time with an informal agreement? It does not compute with me.
Right. And I think what's missing in this article is that it's likely that folks who might support an informal agreement would also support adjusting the acquisition plan and the programs of record to meet informal agreements, and that would be just a terrible thing to do. Jim, your thoughts on that?
Well, maybe we should have a semi-informal agreement. And then maybe we could have a pseudo nearly almost. But, you know, it's just ridiculous to look at this. It looks like it's grasping at straws, which is not where the United States should be right now. We should not be grasping at straws. We should be looking at the strategic landscape and saying what will bring Putin and his folks back to the table to negotiate. Now, you know, I was thinking about this while you were responding here, Curtis, yeah. And it made me think in another way. And I'm gonna do a counter to what you said. You said he pulled out of the agreement so he could cheat on the agreement. There's another reason to pull out of the START treaty, and that is to use it as a negotiating tool, as an interference tool, perhaps, and us getting involved more in Ukraine or on the energy front or anything else, because now it becomes a tool to bring us back to the table. Sure. And why we shouldn't be doing this, grasping at straws for informal agreements or strongly worded letters or nasty views or, you know, Twitters or tweets or whatever. Let's get to the table and bargain for something strategic that's on the table. Or if he's not serious, let's take a serious strategic action and move them to the table. That's what would bring us there. This wouldn't do either of those things.
Well, again, I would to piggyback your argument, Jim. Putin likely suspended this treaty, you know, for two mm-hmm. reasons. One, it was not in his national interest to comply. In other words, it was more beneficial for him to get out of it than it was to stay in. In other words, and to say it again, He doesn't fear us and the repercussions of leaving a treaty in such a way, right? Of course, they play this game. Well, we haven't left the treaty. We've just suspended the treaty and these sorts of things. And then the other thing was, is of course, to coerce us from our support to Ukraine. This is sort of the cost of doing business, America. If you're going to support our enemy, we're not going to, sort of scratch your idealist desires of a meaningless treaty that we're not going to follow anyway. But it makes you feel good as we proceed into the future. So we're 1 year away, right, from this treaty that we're in all by ourselves from expiring, and only then are American arms control people even willing to say, but maybe by then we can begin to do other things if there's not a new treaty to follow on. And all this treaty is doing is constraining us, in my opinion. And that's a tough thing to have. And this spills over, I think, to our allies. And because they care about what we have, right? Extended deterrence, the promise that we will be there for them and that we will use our numbers to provide security for them so that they won't proliferate and build their own, has always been a big challenge. It was mentioned in the Secretary of State report on the New START that we opened the show with. And so we now have an article came out again on January 21st, Japan's top diplomat to lay out Tokyo's red lines to Trump administration. Iwa will discuss nuclear deterrence, the Senkakus, with Rubio, the new Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. And so this is the gentleman, I think he's the deputy prime minister. He came as an invitation from President Trump to attend the inauguration. By the way, something that's never been done before. And so it's an interesting reach out to close allies like Japan to be able to participate in all of this. And so there was some note about this in this piece. And it says here in the article, in his meeting with Rubio, Iwa is expected to call on the Trump administration to commit to reinforced extended deterrence. I'm not sure what that means, but I suspect when he says, I want you to commit, I think he's asking for something more than just better words or another Washington declaration. I think he wants to see more steel, more plumage and warheads and these sorts of things. And then it says here that Japan and the U.S. set their first guidelines on extended deterrence, including a provision stating that the two countries would be in contact with each other if the U.S. were to use nuclear weapons. I kind of thought we'd be doing that anyway. And they affirm the Article 5 of the Japan-U.S. Treaty, which calls for a response to an armed attack on Japan and applies to all the islands. There was a lot in this piece and in the past about making sure that the Senkaku Islands and the potential dispute with China falls under the treaty. And I remember distinctly in the Obama administration, then Secretary of State Kerry, saying in a news thing on TV, and you could watch it on YouTube, I'm sure, where he said, yes, the Senkaku Islands are part of the treaty. And how that all goes. So clearly Japan is still concerned about American extended deterrence and assurance in their mindset. And so I would say, how does this situation play out to them? They've got a North Korea that is building up and adding. You've got a China that is, of course, expanding at breathtaking speed. And you've got an aggressive Russia. I mean, Japan really lives in a rough neighborhood. And we continue as allies to sort of dissuade them from developing their own nuclear capabilities, whether they want to or not, due to their own internal policies. I get that that's an issue for them. But at some point in time, Japan could become a nuclear power. So let me go to you, Jim, first. How easy would it be, in your opinion, for Japan to become a nuclear power, at least, just not politically, but just through their their ability through to generate the technology and the material and that sort of thing.
Oh, Japan has the technology, the know-how, the knowledge. In my humble opinion, I don't speak specifically for Japan, but they've met all of the sort of the technology gateways to be able to bring themselves in from a gateway, and I think they could do it fairly easily. I'm not sure how much material they would have on hand. They do have nuclear power, so you know they obviously have access to material and the ability to separate and to form. And I also think the safety and security issues. You know, they're a stable government. Yeah. They care about their neighbors. They care about control, et cetera, of their system. So I don't see that as being much of a gateway. I do think they have political and they have civil issues that they would have to overcome because Japan, obviously, their experience with nuclear weapons has not been good from their countryside. However, I want to point to something that sort of came to my mind when I was reading this article, and that is the effect of extended deterrence. And I get it that having extended deterrence gives you the power of the people that are extending that deterrence to you, yet keeps you from developing your own program. But I look at something a little bit different here, and I'm sort of curious what Zach's going to say on this and what you have to say on this. And that is that once, if you have you are an extended deterrent to the United States, and let's say, and I'm not saying we are, I'm just going to throw this out there. Let's say that you think that the United States is extended to its very limits, and then you cheat a little bit. If I was going to cheat a little bit, I would go after the people we extend to, because then we waste our arsenal supporting people we extend to, and now we leave us vulnerable. It becomes sort of a whack-a-mole. But if so the people we've extended to, and I'm not hoping no one's running to the hills on this, but just walk me through. What ends up happening is they become a target. But if they can defend themselves, that takes them off the target list and leads us to focus on our mainland and them on their mainland and their nasty neighborhood as well. And so when I read this, that's what I read there, and wonder if that's an underlying thought, because you don't need to shoot a missile very far from, let's say, North Korea to get to Japan. In fact, they've been threatening that way quite a bit in recent years. And so that's my concern about how the extended deterrence works and how it's going to play out in the future as we have more people and our adversaries building more and more weapon systems. Thoughts?
Well, here's how I look at extended deterrence. I'm a big fan of extended deterrence, okay? And here's why. I don't see it as many people do as that's an added burden to us. I see extended deterrence as a force multiplier force. It binds our allies to us in a very real way. It's
interesting.
It's more so than pretty much anything else. So I don't see it as a burden. I see it as a unique way that our allies and us can be focused. There will be a lot of other things we'll disagree on, things or that. But when it comes to it, we both know that in this nuclear realm here, we're bound together in a very real, significant way. So I think extended deterrence serves us in a lot of ways. So it's not a burden. A lot of people see it as, well, you know, those are rich countries. Why don't they, you know, take care of themselves and we don't have to worry about it and all the other stuff. Are you gonna trade one city for one of ours or anything of that? All that stuff is again, as chaff and flares here. What this is all about is this is a very significant way that we show an ironclad commitment to our allies, and our allies know that they depend on us. So when we do things that enhance extended deterrence, that helps us in a very real way. And what I find so fascinating about it is, you know, we're old, you know, the three of us are very old men. I mean, we're, 125, 135 years old, it seems, right? But do you remember, combined. Do you remember when we were young officers? What was public opinion in Japan, in South Korea, about extended deterrence, about our nuclear? We weren't wanted. we were not there. I remember at times that you can't go to Seoul because there's a big anti-nuclear demonstrations. Thank you. Going on. I mean, Japan is like, you are not, you know, going to dock a nuclear powered carrier or sub on in our decks. Oh my gosh. Now in our old age, look how this has changed. And so, this is not a idle thing that, oh, well, if we're not going to provide it, they're not going to develop their own weapons there. And well, hey, public opinion now has completely shifted in a very real way in our lifetimes here. This isn't 75 years ago. We're talking the early 90s when from the early 90s to today. So I think there are very real reasons, and I've always been a proponent of us demonstrating it in very real ways. And whether they're bomber task force, they're naval ships going, or putting equipment wherever it needs to go, very real ways that we are committed to extended deterrence. I think it helps us. It certainly is something that we should do more of, demonstrating our commitment to extended deterrence, not just in Asia, but in Europe and everywhere else where it's where people are depending on us, allies are depending on us for extended deterrence.
Well, now I'm sure you remember 2009-ish, circa 2009. We pulled the TLAMs off the submarines, and as part of the preparation for the New STAR Treaty under guidance from President Obama at the time, and that was pretty upsetting to the Japanese and the extended deterrence mission. I wonder if the part of the motivation for Slick Amen and bringing that sort of system online would be something to sort of really get after the appetite, the extended deterrence appetite of the Japanese and others, maybe the Koreans as well. And I throw one more thing out to you, because General, I really get your thoughts on this, is that I very much think that the issue that we have today from Japan, who has talked, has flirted with the conversation of having nuclear power, certainly under Prime Minister Abe, the late Prime Minister Abe. And I even believe that the current one, forgive me, I can't remember his name at the moment, is ready to have those kinds of conversations domestically. And at some point in time, you know, Japan and Germany have to kind of realize that World War II is over, and it's a new world out there. But how much of this problem that, you know, quote unquote, we have today are created by the inability of Americans to stop the up armament by North Koreans in the 90s and into the 2000s, and our inability to deter a rising China?
Jim. I threw that one to you.
He's throwing that one to you, Jim.
Throws that back to me. Well, you know, so it is sort of curious you say that, Curtis, because I think Americans have probably the shortest memory of any country in the world. And so the fact that you go all the way back to World War II now, I've been to Europe, and you're exactly right. People still remember, because, you know, you had boots on the ground, you had family members, et cetera, and, you know, whole family groups that were taken out during that time. So, yeah, I think if nothing else, the discussion does highlight a question of where are we heading, and whether Japan is saying we really do want to go nuclear because we don't trust the U.S. I don't necessarily hear that. Or do we want to put this on the table so it, just like everything else, it becomes a negotiating point? My point, I said earlier, was not that of saying the extended deterrence was at all a burden, but it provides us with more options. We have more locations from which to launch weapons. We have more stable weapon platforms. We don't have to, you know, we could do more secretive movement of nuclear forces in the sea and potentially on the ground. It gives to me, I like having lots of options, and that's where I'm coming from. So it's a little different than that. Although it still is that we must negotiate. And I do agree wholeheartedly that all negotiations, and we'll go back to the very beginning, even the treaty with Putin gets us to talk, gets us to relate, gets us to trade some information, because I'm a scientist. I like working with data. If I don't have data, I got to work on nothing or make assumptions. And you know what assumptions do? I won't say
that. Yeah, I agree.
It's a family show, Jim.
What do you think, Zach?
I also point out, and this article points out too, it's almost a plea for, hey, can we just talk more about this? Can we just get together? And you know,
right.
And I'm a big extended deterrence guy. Hey, nothing is cooler than sending bombers over, you know, and doing great training missions, sending ships, deploying assets and all this other stuff. Sometimes though, it's just let's involve you in our war games. Let's involve you in our process. Let's talk about how we would work through these things. We're just not going to come in and say, okay, hey, there's a big crisis here. We're going to do this and that now. And I'm not saying we would do that, but what, you know, how much are we discussing this and talking about this with them? How much are we bringing them into our planning, our discussions? How much are we saying, hey, and that does a lot to just calm some of the, you know, the uncertainty out there that will they really come? Mm-hmm. Well, hey, you know, let's just talk about how we together can work about that. And I think that's what that article really was getting at. Hey, I don't think anybody there would argue that, if we could strike a deal with the North Koreans, you know, hey, why wouldn't you want to do that? Right. Why couldn't you? It'd be better for everybody if we could strike a verifiable, real good deal with the North Koreans. But barring that, and I don't think anybody in any of these countries would say, oh, you shouldn't talk to them or don't try to do something like that. But I just think, don't leave us out. You know, don't shut us out of this. Let us be a part of this, because, frankly, we're the ones right here on the front line of this. And honestly, I don't think we've always done a great job of that. I mean, we've for a host of reasons. And I think a lot of it is because we didn't in our day. I'll go back to our younger days. For a very real reason, we didn't want to do a lot of that is because we didn't want to stoke this anti-nuclear backlash that's there. But what we have to realize is that's gone now. That's gone. This generation is totally so there's nothing wrong. In fact, that's it would be a lot better if we could be a lot more vocal about our extended deterrence and talk more. And I think that's what that article is saying. Hey, we're not telling you don't do any deals here. We're telling you don't do any deals without involving us. And I think that's a very fair and right thing to do.
Absolutely. Right. I think it comes down to communication and in multiple ways, communications with our allies so that they feel more assured and their participation. And I would argue some communication from our State Department. I wish they would be more open with the American people in their reports so we can actually know what's going on. Maybe that will be different as the Trump administration sort of gets themselves settled. This is as we come to that time here where the drive time in the greater DC area is coming to an end. And if it's snowing right now, then you probably have enough time to listen to another previous edition of the NIDS View. So I want to just point you to that. Again, I want to thank our guests today here, General Garrett Herrensack, Dr. Jim Petrosky here, all members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, and remind you, all of our listeners, to check us out on X, where we are tweeting articles and thoughts, and our website at thinkdeterrence.com. Check out our articles and editorials in the national security world on globalsecurityreview.com. Hit us up on LinkedIn. follow us. We're trying to be everywhere all the time. We also have the show. You can watch these videos, these NIDS views on YouTube and on Rumble. Look for us on Rumble. And if you hit either one of those, like and share, please like and share. Okay. Thank you very much, folks, for being here. And for you, the listener, thank you for spending a little bit of time with us here this week. And we look forward to being in your ears next week as we continue this journey and remind you all to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.